Good evening and welcome, dear ones. Each of your presences is a blessing to all of us. So as we gaze at one another, we welcome one another into this circle, a circle of great intention. We take our place. We come here to engage in a conscious exchange, to feed and to be fed by the impressions we are receiving. May our work be for lifting the consciousness of our world and ourselves. In the name of God, the Father, the Source, God, the Omnipresent, the All, God, the Immanent, the Spirit of Life, eternally whole and one, yet manifested as the many. Amen. So tonight for our remembrance, we will again turn to Louise Gepford March, whose extraordinary notes of Mr. Gurdjieff give us a behind the scenes glimpse of Gurdjieff, the man, the person with a capital P. And tonight we get a glimpse of life at the Priory during the rewriting and the rewriting of Beelzebub's tales, and the effort that was spent in this writing venture. She says, many evenings in the salon with its beautiful gray walls and red curtains, a chapter of Beelzebub's tales was read in Russian, French, German, or English, depending upon which guests were at the Priory. Regardless of the language read, I felt the flow of the chapter and recognized certain words. And as I began to know the content of the chapters, it didn't matter which language they were read in. The unfamiliar Russian was like a dress which clothed a familiar body. There slowly developed in us the capacity to make oneself empty, to learn to open, to listen. Something new can enter only when there is space. This is a much more difficult process than most want to believe. It is the freeing of the purely subjective thinking and picturing kaleidoscope, which we received automatically, and the acquisition of a consciously functioning, ever true, objective wealth in its place. During the reading, Gurdjieff watched the listeners to evaluate what he had written and the exactness of its translation. New guests were surprised that he considered a single word or the flow of a sentence so very important. But we translators already knew that Gurdjieff was the teacher of exactness. For us, the translation was a school that freed us from our subjective conceptions and views. Thanks to the creation of a new exact language, we came to an understanding which we couldn't have imagined in the beginning. With Gurdjieff, we came to use words precisely. And so it is in our work that we are learning a language to be able to communicate with one another objectively. Tonight, we will be engaging a complex subject, so we're invited to meet it with the high intentionality of which it has been prepared for us, to create a place of reception, to make ourselves empty, to open, to listen, perhaps clothe ourselves with this teaching, and something new may enter and happen. And so be it. We can't help but wonder about those 50 that were with Mr. Gurdjieff, and he moved into the Priory in 1922 in October. with those blessed 50, most of whom we will never know, but they prepared the foundation for our work. So now we prepare ourselves, our own foundation, for the work to enter. A time of preparation to receive new influences. A rare privilege. How many are there who would even be interested in these ideas? Am I? Will I play my part? Will I work for the future? Will I clothe myself with these ideas and let them envelop me? All three centers, softly, quietly. We prepare ourselves here and now with intention and immanent trust, taking perhaps all the heaviness of life and lifting it in hope and love in the midst of our own vulnerability. With back upright, stilled, contained, we scan our bodies, perhaps noticing and then letting go of any points of tension and constriction, particularly noticing the small muscles of the face, which carry an enormous amount of tension ordinarily. We breathe in deeply, all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything, everything that passed through us this day, our world today, everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy and hope, all affirming, all denying. And we hold it as offering, reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that all be transubstantiated in our being, as whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing light into the world, all worlds. In this breathing, we sense that all is flowing, becoming, in every particle of this universe. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I yield to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. We now enter into the time of Lectio Divina. And our reading will be done three times with a silent pause in within each reading. There are celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one kind and that of the terrestrial another. There is one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon and another glory of the stars. For star differs from star in brightness. We talk about struggling, observing, working, and even about receiving guidance from more experienced people than ourselves. All of this is right, but none of it can begin, and none of it can lead anywhere unless something enters into us which can draw us higher, towards the higher. We are given help, but we have to learn how to accept, how to put ourselves under. It is always completely present here and now. Christ said, "Behold, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." We can taste and we can verify and we can practice here and now. This is the narrow way. There is no other. There are celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies, but the glory of the celestial is one kind and that of the terrestrial another. There is one glory of the sun and another glory of the moon and another glory of the stars, for star differs from star in brightness. We talk about struggling, observing, working, and even about receiving guidance from more experienced people than ourselves. All of this is right, but none of it can begin, and none of it can lead anywhere unless something enters into us, which can draw us toward the higher. We are given help that we have to learn how to accept, how to put ourselves under. It is always completely present here and now. Christ said, "Behold, I am with you always, even until the end of the world." We can taste and we can verify and we can practice here and now. This is the narrow way. There is no other. There are celestial bodies and terrestrial bodies. But the glory of the celestial is one kind, and that of the terrestrial another. There is one glory of the sun, and another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For star differs from star in brightness. We talk about struggling, observing, working, and even about receiving guidance from more experienced people than ourselves. All of this is right, but none of it can begin, and none of it can lead anywhere unless something enters into us which can draw us toward the higher. We are given help that we have to learn how to accept, how to put ourselves under. It is always completely present here and now. Christ said, "Behold, I am with you always, even until the end of the world." We can taste and we can verify and we can practice here and now. This is the narrow way. There is no other. And so it is. So now I invite you, perhaps someone who hasn't shared for a very long time, to share with us what you received from this passage, or perhaps from that extraordinary image. Elena, good evening and welcome.
Welcome. Do you hear me?
Yes, I do.
Well, it was like this passage, it was like really so eye-opening. And I took a picture, a photo, that I have it on my cell phone, which I'm going to read, but it's really so clear what it says here. We talk about struggling, observing, working, and even about receiving guidance from more experienced people than ourselves. Okay, that's one point. That's something that many times we do, like listening to a person, listen to another person. And as it says here, this is all right, but none of it can begin and none of it can lead us anywhere unless something enters into us which can draw us towards a higher.
Yes.
So clear. It is so clear. And the following is also like very, very clear. We're given help that we have, we are given help that we have to learn how to accept, how to put ourselves under. It's always completely present here and now. Yeah. It's like this passage is, it's so clear.
So clear. Yes. Thank you, Elena. Amen. I saw, before you, Steve, I saw Alan, and then perhaps he changed his mind or something happened. Alan, do you care to share first? Maybe not. Well, Steve, good evening and welcome.
Kind of reminded me of that YouTube ad where the chipmunk comes up and goes, Alan, Alan, Alan. And then he switches to Steve, Steve, Steve.
That'll be me.
Yeah.
Yes.
What I usually don't go to the diagram, but the diagram grabbed me because I saw the circulatory system. At the base of it was the heart. And I could very clearly see the right heart and the right heart receiving and the left heart pumping out. And there's a circulatory system above. So it's kind of the trogo auto egocrat. I mean, it's this reciprocal feeding where involution comes into us and then we evolve up and we feed upwards and we're fed by a central circulation and it's all communicating. So that's what I got out of the diagram.
Yes. Well, thank you, Steve. Thank you. The diagram is definitely extraordinary. Greta, good evening.
Good evening. I saw the diagram as well, and it was so full for me. First of all, I saw the two teardrops touching, and it reminded me of the sign for infinity. And they were all over the painting. It was like being in a multiverse. That is, that there were so many levels that, and so many possibilities that were represented by that. And then I saw the rays of creation coming down from the top of the diagram into the heart. And the, as Stephen said, that intertwining, it was almost like a tree of knowledge and wisdom that was entering into the heart. And the other thing it reminded me of was the tree of the Kabbalah or the tree of wisdom. Yeah. And it was really impressive and beautiful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Greta. Marcia, good evening, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I loved the reading, but I too am going to comment on the image. And what really caught my eye first was the birds. Mm. I noticed in almost the middle of the image, there are two birds that seem to be not having anything to do with each other. And then the next image higher, they seem to be relating to each other. And then in the top image, there's just one bird. And so it kind of represented our path to union. And then I also noticed that it was like a Venn diagram with the circles too. There were two circles that were slightly intersecting and then more of an intersection. And then the top one was just one circle. And it was very, very interesting image. Thank you for that.
Yes, thank you, Marcia. Thank you. Marky, good evening. Oops, you need to unmute. Yeah. There you go.
Okay, hi. I just want to, it's kind of a rhetorical question that in the passage, it says we are given the help, but we have to put ourselves under, you know, like submit to it.
Yeah.
And I'm just assuming that that help is the work, the narrow way, the only way. That is that ballpark? I mean, is that the obvious?
It must be to you. It must be to you. Yes. Just it's there to stir in your heart, to receive it. Let it speak to you and come to meet you. Yes, but definitely the work is.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Marky.
Thank you.
Camille, good evening.
Good evening. I saw the image as with the birds representing the Holy Spirit. Mm. And as we submit ourselves to the Spirit, we receive help. And as we move up, the Spirit moves up with us and becomes interrelated birds. And then at the top, a single one. And when I first saw the image this morning, it looked like the top was just two dots, maybe a Mobius. I couldn't really tell. But tonight, it looked like at the top was an angel. Mm-hmm. And to me, that represented our growth with the help of the Holy Spirit.
Indeed. Thank you, Camille. Thank you. Well, thank you to each of you who have shared, and to everyone with the thoughts of your hearts that are there for us as an atmosphere, if you will. So now this evening we're going to move directly into our time with Robin Bloor, and I am just filled with joy at Robin's presence, that we get to engage these most profound ideas. And so we're asked to just listen to them, clothe ourselves with them, live into them, verifying as we are able. So we will receive Robin's presentation and have an extended time of Q&A or sharing afterwards. Good evening and welcome, Robin, among us.
Thank you. Thank you for your, thank you for inviting me. I shall share my presentation. Can everybody see that? So this really, this presentation is really, it has to be about two things. It cannot be about one. So it's possible to discuss the four bodies of man, but it's only really possible to do that, in my experience anyway, by paying attention to the idea of time. So there are two strands to this. So in terms of an agenda, I'm going to talk about the four bodies as a kind of definitional level, and then I'm going to talk about the relative nature of time, which means that I have to talk about linear time, circular time, and recurrence. Kairos times, if you're familiar with that, the map of a life, the third dimension of time, the universe, and then back to the four bodies. So this, I mean, the first image is the horse, the carriage, and the driver, and we need to have this, if you like, firmly established in ourselves, because it's far more than just a metaphor or an allegory. It does refer to the four different bodies, the carriage being the physical body, the normal feelings and desires, being the beating heart of the Kesjian body or the astral body. The driver forming the seed of the spiritual body or the mental body. And the divine or causal body, which is what can emerge with the growth of the two lower bodies, the astral and the spiritual body. The word Kesjian, if you didn't know, it's the word Gurdjieff chooses. It means half soul. It's not a complete soul. And the astral body, however, is what you are. It's a master of energy. It's a source of feelings, and it is what you came as. The mental body could also be called the body of reason. And it, like essence, like the Kesjan body, is undeveloped. The divine body is formed from the marriage of the second and third bodies with the higher centers, if you can make that happen. So this is a quote from Gurdjieff, that time is the unique subjective. It's only five words there, but it is incredibly deep in terms of the implications of that. And I mean, let me just kind of repeat that. Time is the only thing that is always subjective. So we have the relative nature of time. There's a whole load of words in Beelzebub's tales that I'm not going to read out. But, you know, consider the mayfly. Its life of 2 days apparently passes 15,000 times faster than the life of man. But subjectively, it lives the 70 or 80 years of man. That's the idea of time that Gurdjieff suggested, is that all lifetimes at this level in nature are in fact subjectively the same. They're really quite long, as long as you live, you know, as long as you live your potential. However, at a cellular level, cells live for a similar time period to the cells of man. So logically, it must experience its organic processes, eating, breathing, perceiving, in a different way to man. So if we're just thinking about a bacteria that lives for maybe a day, maybe even only an hour or something, it eats and breathes and perceives at a similar speed because it lives in the orbit of some bacteria live in the orbit of men. So we have this strange kind of thing that, yes, the different lifetimes may be very, very different, but they actually in some way or other have to reconcile within the body of nature. Nature itself, life is measured in many millions of years. This is without dispute, really. And the difference in terms of nature itself is far greater than the difference between man and mayfly. Relatively speaking, man has been a feature of nature for less than a day in the life of nature. That is just taking the scientific perspective that man appeared on this planet maybe 20,000 years ago, maybe 100,000. Nature has been here pretty much since the beginning. In relation to planets and suns, the lifetime of our species is infinitesimal. The life of an individual man in respect of the life of a planet, very close to zero. So this is... how should we understand time? And the first thing is that we look at time as a linear thing. We're kind of taught to do that. It's the only way it's ever presented to us in school, if you like, and later on by the mouthpieces of science. But linear time is actually the time of the first body. It's the time of a physical body. We're programmed from an early age to experience as time. So we get this kind of diagram where we stand at now and we look back and behind us is birth and behind that conception. And we look forward and we see death. And the past and the future seem to be kind of just a simple dimension of a line. And I'm going to paint a very different picture than that. But it is a difficult idea to oppose because we've been programmed. But we know, as soon as we came in contact with the work, we didn't perhaps think of it in this way or speak of it in this way, but we knew that when we were present, time was just different. Very significantly different. You could go for a drive, let's say, for half an hour or an hour, And you could be there for almost no time at all. It could just be the robot driving. And often it is. But if you have even 10 seconds of presence, it lasts an awful lot longer than the 1 hour car journey. So there's a kind of strange thing that we occupy levels, and the time in those levels is different. And in the tales, when Gurdjieff refers to the ever-shortening life of man, he's really referring to that. He's referring to the fact that modern life, in the way it's lived, is a mechanical life, and therefore most people don't have much of a life in terms of time that they've really experienced things. So if we move from that, when we move to the idea of circular time, and that brings us into with the idea of recurrence, and that's if we're born with an essence, then the question is, where did that come from? And where will it go at our death? So it's not difficult to entertain the idea of time moving in a circle. You can just draw it that way. And you make the moment of conception the same as the moment of death. And Rodney Collin wrote an excellent book about this called The Theory of Eternal Life, which I recommend that people read. Because we need to get, in some way or another, we need to get a sense of this circular recurrence, or the possibility of circular recurrence. It doesn't make the experience any less linear, by the way. But, you know, to think of it in those terms, it starts to make sense of the idea of multiple bodies. And the circularity of time introduces the idea of reincarnation and recurrence. So we have the idea of an exact recurrence. I am born, I go through my life, I die, and I am reborn as the same individual as before. In the same time, I do the same things, I live the same life. And this is, of course, a nightmare. And this is something that Uspensky talked about in considerable depth. So when you die, you're conceived at exactly the same time you were conceived in this life. It's in order to actually look at it this way, and I'll kind of go into this a bit more later, you have to see time as three-dimensional. If it's three-dimensional, then there isn't any reason why you can't go back to a point in the past. But it's possible that you get a kind of cyclical recurrence where the life changes. And that would mean that you did something differently. Your life repeated, but you did something differently. And in doing something differently, when you were eventually reborn, you were born in a slightly different version of yourself. So this idea of the kairos time. The Greek word kairos, it means the right, critical, or opportune moment for something. And if we are mechanical, and most of us who actually examined ourselves do come to the conclusion that we are very much mechanical, then the question is, how is that possible that there could be any change in it? The Greek idea of kairos times is that you live your life, but at certain points in time, it can change because you do have the possibility of making a choice. And maybe the next time you live a particular life, maybe you make a different choice. So this is outer life, a very few moments, crossroads events when change is possible. In fact, if our behavior is entirely mechanical, there would be no moments where it would be possible. But our behavior isn't entirely mechanical. We have moments, and those moments often coincide with making choices. if you want to do something interesting in respect of your own life, sit down impartially with a piece of paper, I'd know, at a table or something, and just write down the decisions that made your life what it is. Just write down what were the decisions that made me into what I've become. My experience was there were not many decisions. And in order that the life would be different, then you would have to make different decisions at those points, which we can call Kairos times. When we work on ourselves and change our being, we actually change our life. This isn't, in my opinion, this isn't easy to explain. The idea that we live in a world of cause and effect is something that most people have bought as the explanation to everything. But in the work, the idea is that if you increase your being, you attract a different life. And that the being itself is what attracts the outside events. So your being attracts your life. And there's also, this isn't just an idea from the work, but Gurdjieff spoke of the enlightened idiot, one of the many idiots that he used to toast in his toasting ceremony. And he said about the enlightened idiot that he cannot become, he cannot perfect himself because of a fault in grandma. But if he works on himself diligently, even grandma will change. And this is, if you like, this is an idea that isn't just something that came through Gurdjieff. In the Taoist view of the world, they say you are responsible for seven generations behind you and seven in front of you, and that you have to work for the perfection of those that have yet to come and those that have already been. So I've drawn a kind of map. It's just a model, if you like, a representation. But if we use the idea of Kairos and the fact that at certain points different decisions may be made, we can represent a person's life as a network of possible paths. It begins with the conception and birth, like that, following which there appears a multitude of possible paths. And if we take this path, then at some point those decisions can be made, and at some point different decisions can be made. And we get a kind of, it's almost like a tree, if you like, a multitude of possible paths that a life can take. And there's a key down at the bottom. At various junctures, at Kairos times, different possibilities occur. And naturally, all of those red dots just represent a death. And, you know, it's been drawn deliberately, so it looks like some of these lives are long, some of them are not so long. So if we were talking about exact recurrence, then you would just be repeating exactly one path through your life. But there's also the fact of the bloodline. If you have this idea of cyclical recurrence, then every possible life path may be traversed. Some could even be traversed several times. You could explore all the possibilities of the body that you were born into. And the traversing of more than one path obviously implies that something changed, better or worse, but something. But you see, on some paths, children will be conceived. And therefore, this isn't just a map of how your life may be, it's the map of your whole bloodline, and the map of not just the bloodline that you have with the children that you have, if you have children, but the bloodlines that are possible in different lives that create other children that in this life don't exist. So these just represent possibilities of children being born. These are little green dots. So conceptions link together many lives into families. These in turn create tribes and ultimately races. And all those could be mapped in a way. We can't escape from the fact that we are part, not just of humanity, but part of a very specific part of humanity. So now we approach the idea of reincarnation. So we now have the possibility not just of having to relive the same life, but you could actually enter a life that's distinctly different, where you were, you know, maybe far in the future, who knows where that would come into existence. But the seed of magnetic center is in essence. Although eyes forms in personality and association with it, it's that that in one way or another will guide us to a different incarnation, if that's something that's possible for us. So some paths of life are going to create a stronger magnetic center you meet, you know, stronger people to influence you in a particularly positive way, let's say, draws some people to the work, and then the change of being can actually is achieved, to be honest. And so there are just some paths of life that include the possibility of escaping from this recurrence. And this means reincarnation into a different life, as represented in the diagram. And we represent both going to a higher life or possibly going to a lower life, but it's reincarnation. So we have to look at time as a spiral. Once you put in the idea of reincarnation, then this lifetime can lead to this lifetime, can lead to this lifetime, and so on. It's very, if you like, it's very much in line with the idea of ideas in Buddhism of the Bodhisattva, who is gradually reincarnating his way to nirvana. So we have three dimensions. The first dimension, linear time. The second dimension, circular, hence planar time, and that implies a recurrence. And the third dimension is the spiral. And that means we have three dimensions of time. And we're measuring, curiously, we're measuring time not in terms of one lifetime anymore. We're measuring it in terms of the possibilities of a lifetime. And the reason that I'm introducing these ideas is I don't think there's any way of making sense of the four bodies without having this idea at the back of it. The words used to describe the limits of time is eternity, and eternity is three-dimensional. So that would imply a six-dimensional universe. We have three dimensions of time, linear time, recurrence, and eternity, and we have three dimensions of place. Now, the theory in the work is that time, the hero path, acts on a cosmos. In fact, it acts on all cosmoses except the absolute and the sun absolute. Thus, we could say mathematically that every cosmos inherently has six dimensions. It's place, length, and breadth and height in terms of the whole Megalo cosmos. It is at a point somewhere in the whole universe. Its now is within its lifetime, its recurrence, and its eternity at some point within the eternity of the universe. It also has scale. Its scale in relation to the ray of creation. These seven dimensions determine its place in the Trogawato ego crash. And this idea, which I think you are at least reasonably familiar of the Chogyamato ego crowd. We occupy a place and we have a particular duty in that place in order to create certain substances. You know, and we don't think of ourselves as being creators of certain substances, but in fact, from the perspective of the universe, that's exactly what we are. We're cosmoses that create substances that serve other cosmoses. So we have the idea of the three bodies in collaboration in the food diagram. I'll go through this very quickly because it's really possible to actually spend a vast amount of time on this. So we have the octave of food, which sustains the physical body. And then we have the octave of air, which sustains and supports the Kesjan body. But it's also dependent on the physical body. These two, as you can see, they in one way or another, they rise in parallel. And it is also dependent for it to get as far as it's got here on us making the effort for the first conscious shot. The impressions octave supports the Kesjan body, but depends upon the second conscious shot to complete itself. And this is the body, if you like, of reason. And taken together in their perfection, we have the body of the master. So from the point of view of the way that we behave, the way that we are, man number 1, 2, and 3 are automatons, they're robots. They're external impressions that they experienced, engendered desires, influence for creating contradictory wills, and that's how they live their life. And that's illustrated at the bottom. The carnal or physical body is active, and while that is active, we are effectively automatons. And the first body lives either under the law of accident, or if it rises above that, it never gets beyond cause and effect, right? It doesn't experience fate. It is doomed to recurrence within its local eternity. The work aims eventually to reverse the whole set of relationships. So the master is governing, is the governing entity, and other bodies are subservient to it. So the arrow runs in exactly the opposite direction. It runs from the master, which you could say manifests a consciousness and a will and an I, a genuine I, if you like, an unfragmented I. And the other bodies are simply, well, they're actually functions almost of this higher body. And the four bodies have got distinctively different densities. I can go into this in great depth, but it would take a long time. But you can think of the physical body as being a body of water, and the Kesjan body as being the body of air, and the body of reason being a body of plasma, and the body of the master is incandescent plasma. It's higher still. You can look at it in terms just of the energies that they are, if you like, manifest. The hydrogens of mentation, that is how they, if you like, psyche work, is shown in the boxes above. And you can see, I mean, you can see that the average hydrogen of the physical body is hydrogen 96, which is the energy of the immune system. And that's really what that body is expressing in one way or another. Its highest manifestation is personality. But the astral body is one step above that, which is a considerable step above that in actual fact. And its highest manifestation is at the level of emotion, if you like, but more normal emotion. The spiritual or mental body, its highest manifestation is at the highest point of its really its presence. And the divine body, its highest manifestation is hydrogen 6, which embodies the ability to transform negativity. So, I mean, and it can be defined in this way as if we were just doing chemistry. Not until we get to the third body do we actually have a three-brained mind. And of course, at the end, it's a perfected mind. And these, well, they can be thought of as different orders of being, but actually that's what they are. They're different orders by a long way. And normal man and man as we, certainly as at the point where we came to the work, we're a combination of a physical body, an astral body that's not complete, and a body of reason or mental body that's not complete. And our job in this lifetime is to try to complete as much of those two bodies as possible. If we look at it from the perspective of the ray of creation, I'm trying to give you all pictures, if you like. We can see that these, you know, the physical body, it belongs to the earth, actually sometimes to the moon. But the body question belongs to the planet, which is why it has fate. The mental body, the body of reason, belongs to the sun, which I always think of the sun as the lowest level of Jesus Christ. He exists and shines like the sun. But in fact, he exists beyond the sun. He exists at the level of the galaxy. And this is where the divine body could eventually manifest. These bodies are immortal within the life of their particular stratum. So a properly formed Kesdian body, if it chooses to be, is immortal in the life of the planet on which it was created. And a mental body, immortal in the life of the sun. And the divine body, immortal in the life of the galaxy. The body Kesdian, when crystallized, can survive at death. It has achieved unity of a kind. Until then, it can die and may soon die after the death of the physical body. It isn't a partially formed Kesdian body. It's not immortal. The idea that we will just be born again and try again is an interesting idea, but it can have the fate where it just becomes food for something else because it was an experiment that failed. The mental body, immortal within the life of the planets, the level of man number 6, divine body, immortal within the life of the solar system. And that's man number 7. So I've gone through that. I don't suppose there's any questions, is it? So, Mark.
So, I have a question. So, something that I read in the work a long time ago, and I can't actually remember where, although I suspect it was either Nicol or Uspensky, but they were talking about deja vus as a leak from a previous recurrence. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts or experience with that, because I've observed in myself that I used to have deja vus all the time, but the last one I can remember was a couple of years after joining CCH. So I don't know, maybe that's wishful thinking, I don't know, but it was just a question I had.
Well, I mean, there's one thing that should be clear. If you read about the last years of Uspensky, I've been working on a book about Rodney Cullen, who was the guy that knew Uspensky better than anyone else. In the last years of his life, he was going around re-experiencing the places he'd been because he wanted to imprint them on his memory. And he had the suspicion that he might be reincarnated as in a similar life to the one that he had. I personally, sometimes I just know how things are going to pan out, if you like, and I don't know how I know that. And it's nothing, mostly it's trivial. And if that's a recurrence, then that's a recurrence. But it could also be explained as clairvoyance. And maybe those two things are actually the same. You know, because maybe the different words for the same thing. We don't know. The question is the trace of memory. You see, another term that has been used in some of the writing that I've encountered in respect to the body occasion is to refer to it as a body of habits. And the idea being that if you can't do anything extraordinary in your life and become a saint or something like that, then what you must attempt to do is to improve your body of habits, because it'll come back as a body of habits. And I think you get these impossible to explain. People like Mozart was impossible to explain. At the age of 4, he was the best musician in Europe. I mean, that's just impossible to explain, other than by saying his body of habits included an extraordinary musical capability.
Right.
So that's how I look at it, and as the body. And you see, I remember an event in my adolescence where a friend of mine knew what was going to happen next. It wasn't me, it was him. And there was nothing extraordinary about him, and he didn't really do anything extraordinary about his life. But, you know, there we were walking around an abandoned house, and he knew what was going to be in the next room. And we hadn't been in it. We just kind of stumbled on this place.
Mm-hmm.
It just kind of knew, you know. And I always thought things like that, well, they're curious. And they indicate at least that the boundaries that people tend to draw around themselves in respect of the possibilities of a life are probably should never be drawn.
Thank you.
So, Robin?
Yeah, hi, thanks, Robin. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine.
Yeah. So the whole idea of recurrence for me gives me so much hope and really so much impetus to continue my work in this lifetime, knowing that, you know, my parents might change, like you said, my grandma, and affect the lives of everybody else, and including this whole group of people that we're with right now, being in this work together and having the relationships that we have. We're all changing our next recurrence. It's just so hopeful to me, the idea that, you know, all the conscious periods that I've had in my life, went through cancer, the death of my daughter, as consciously as possible, and did so much work during those times, thinking that, well, you know, hopefully that will have changed things in the next recurrence. And like I said, I just find that so incredibly hopeful, and that it just seems like, of course, God would do it this way.
Well, I mean, it depends on which direction you look at it from, but it is entirely consistent as an idea, and therefore entirely defensible if you just look at it as a scientific scientific model for the way that the universe works. I mean, that's one thing. But here's something. I came to the work because I didn't know what I was. And when I said I didn't know what I was, I didn't know what I was. It wasn't that I didn't know this Robin Bloor thing that I am occupying at the moment. I just didn't know what I was. And I didn't feel as though I was. And when I consider the idea of death, I find it very difficult to envisage that whatever animates this body is not going to persist beyond that. I just find it very difficult because it exists, and I've had experience where it has existed outside of the normal bounds of the physical body. So I'm something, but I don't know what it is. And my expectation is that when this physical body dies, something will leave it and it will go somewhere. And I like this particular theory because it's consistent and because it's well articulated by Uspensky and Rodney Collin and Maurice Nicol and Gurdjieff. You know, it's not like this is a wacky idea from the fringes of the work. This is central. But there's still a mystery. I mean, I was about to throw it back to you. There's still a mystery. You know, you have had a particular life and you've had experiences that were tough, as you've described, and the question is why. And it may be that it was necessary.
Absolutely. As you said, our being draws our life.
And it's a very... I think, you know, for me at the moment, and this is, if you like, this is just very me-centric, but it seems that at the moment that the events that happen to me point out my defects.
Yeah.
And that it's very gentle. It's not like somebody is hammering at the front door and knocking it down and dashing in and saying, you know, you're a reckless idiot, stop it. That isn't what's happening. But what is happening is I'm attracting various kinds of light that shine upon me and illuminate parts of myself. And, you know, and it's a difficult thing, right? I mean, one of the things that I do, and I've been doing this now for several years, is that whenever a thought arises and I've got enough presence to realize that an association just got triggered, you know, I overheard a conversation in the supermarket or something, and all of a sudden I'm back to when, you know, I was 25 years old and the event occurred, and that's triggered it. And it's like, I'm just walking bunch of memories. But you see, now, whenever I have anything suddenly arise, I ask it a question, which is, where did you come from? And you can do that. And it'll tell you. And it seems to me that pretty much everything that happens in my life, in the way it responds to outside influences, comes either from my childhood or from my adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it comes from.
Well, and also what you bring up about, especially about memories and traveling back, you know, in our own time bodies, the fact that we can actually, you know, change the past is all part of, I guess you could go on and on with that in the talk that you're given as well.
Yeah, and you're quite correct. I mean, one of the things that is, let's say that the first time I encountered it in my kind of upbringing, at the time when I never took Christianity seriously, there's this idea of redemption. And me as a cynical adolescent immediately thought, well, it's just a cop-out, isn't it? Mm. But it isn't a cop-out, it's the opposite. It's the reality is that it doesn't matter what you did, right? There is a possibility of redemption, but you have to accept what you did 100%. And this is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is beautiful. It really is. To me, that's real hope, what hope means.
Yeah, real hope. Yeah, it's okay. It's as opposed to hoping that I win the lottery.
Yeah, which could be bad or good.
Yeah, I mean, that's always one of the things that amuses me is that every now and then somebody does an investigation over the past 10 years or so to people that won huge prizes. And pretty much everybody destroyed their life. And that's what you would expect, really, when you think about it, is that they had, let's say, specific weaknesses and faults. And they were showered with money and they never knew how to handle that because their weaknesses and faults were the things that grabbed the money. Almost ironic. It's like, you know, I don't wish evil on people, but there is a saying in the UK, which is be careful of what you want, for you shall get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Nichols always saying we're always wishing or praying for the wrong thing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
Well, it's been good talking to you.
You too.
Jamie.
Hey, Robin. I feel like my question might be elementary, so I'll apologize before time. You said earlier you are responsible for seven generations, and I had an inclination that might be related to the sins of my forefathers. I was wondering if I feel like I inherited them, and I have a young son and daughter and a young daughter, and I feel like I don't want to pass. I've been working on not passing down impressions or associations to them. And is there a shortcut or is there a secret you can give us?
In terms of repairing the past.
Mm-hmm. Or the future.
Well, in actual fact, the if you think of yourself as standing on a line of time, and then you regard yourself as rising up above the line of time and seeing it now as a kind of landscape of time, right? If you repair something in the past, you'll repair it in the future as well. It'll work in both directions. So what we're actually trying to do, it almost seems paradoxical because we're trying to be precisely now. We're trying to be in the moment, and the more we are attached directly to the moment, the more presence we have, because we've taken away the energies that were trapped in the past. So I think the idea of acknowledging faults. First of all, there are a number of things that you can do in this respect, but one of them is to play the following idea. When you actually find yourself in the company of somebody, mm-hmm. and you find them in some way or other off-putting, you have to ask yourself, or the exercise is to ask yourself, why am I like that? Because almost certainly what you're seeing and what you're objected to is something in you. And in actual fact, what anybody else is doesn't matter at all. So the idea, one of the ideas of the work, but it's a very powerful conception, if you like, but it's not often given and discussed as far as I know, anyway. Not in the circles that I've been in, is external events don't matter at all. They absolutely don't matter. There's nothing that can happen to you now, today, tomorrow, in a month, in a year. There's nothing that can happen to you that matters at all. None of it. The only thing that actually matters is how you digest it. Whatever you send, how you digest it. That's what matters. So you actually stand on this borderline between the inner world and the outer world. And you're looking out because in one way or another, there are various things in the nature of the outside world that you have to be aware of. You know, you don't go walking into the middle of a street when there are cars coming. So there are things that you have to be aware of. But the major events of your life is your digestion of the events as they occur, and how it affects your inner life, because the external events don't matter. They just don't matter at all. And I say this as someone who has experienced many tragic events. You know, but the external events don't matter. It's how you consume them that matters. And you see, if you take away a scar, let's say there was a scar when you were 8 years old, there was something that happened and it put a scar on you. And you find a way to redeem that. You've redeemed something in the whole spread of time to now from when that happened. Because a lot of what you have done have been influenced in some way or other by that psychological scar. So you remove that, you're removing, it's almost like there's a curtain that's hanging by many, many different rings from a pole, right? And just by cutting one of those things, the whole curtain falls. And it has a dramatic effect upon you, become a different person. But you see, you have to find those things, and this isn't easy. And the work never encourages people to be over energetic in a particular way. My teacher used to say about people that joined her group and came in with extraordinary enthusiasm. I've now found the work was, you know, obviously an idea that was ringing in the head. She said, that's a fast motorbike to hell. Yeah. And in one way or another, we need to be, if you like, reaching out as far as we can. But we also need to be in harmony in doing it. Because if you go, you know, I mean, I can give you lots of things to do if you really want, that will mess your life up, right? Mm-hmm. It's not hard, because there are some various truths about everybody, and one of them is that you have a battle with your body, right? So without knowing you very well, I can't completely concoct something, but if I knew you better, I'd just find out what your weaknesses are. And advise you to, in one way or another, struggle against something that's going to beat you. Because that's what happens. Is most people, it's like, you know, someone, someone read about some saint or other that stopped eating for 40 days or something, so he decides to do the same himself. One of the things that I think is a story that I tell, and it's a wonderful story in that it demonstrates something, and that's a woman I know had a grandmother who was raped by a man before the Second World War, and she became pregnant. And the man came back from the war because he lived in the town that she was in, and he agreed to marry her. And she lived as his wife for many, many years. And she never once criticized him. She never once held anything against him. He treated her terribly, and she never once complained. And when she died, and she died before he died, it broke him. And he actually became a decent man because he'd lost the only thing that was ever good in his life. So he became a decent man. And the granddaughter of this woman knew about this story, and she got married to someone, and she decided that she was going to give unconditional love, just like her grandmother did. And it broke her because she couldn't do it. And she's divorced, and the whole thing's a mess. But it's a mess because she thought she could do something that's way beyond her strength. But she had a grandmother that could do something like that. So we have to be careful in terms of what we take on. But you see, the other thing is we mustn't be lazy in terms of what we take on either. So you have to find a place in the middle. I hope you do.
Thank you.
Jim? Someone gonna unmute?
Yes. I wonder if you think that, or what do you think about dreams? Are they possible paths that either have been given the go-ahead or have been stopped in their tracks so that they don't play out? Do they have any relationship at all to the paths that we are given?
So, I mean, this is entirely subjective, and it depends upon your experience of dreams. You know, it's like I can guarantee there's a time before you wake up, before I wake up, there's a time that's about an hour or an hour and a half where the sleep is fairly light. And various bits of imagination play out. And Gurdjieff referred to it as the sphere of idiocy. So we have this mechanism. We go through a day and various events occur, and in some way or other, they need to be digested. And when I'm talking about digesting events, mostly we're talking about the emotional side of an event. It's not just that. Somebody could pose a problem to you and it might cycle around in your mind. But mostly when we go to sleep, we're actually just trying to clear that. So dreaming has a function in that way to clear that. And so when we talk about dreaming, we have to set all of that. There's a process of a psychic elimination where we have to get rid of the events of the day, which we don't want them hanging around. We don't want them taking any energy from them. Certain things happen. Maybe something happened and I got annoyed with somebody, and that kind of vibration is still living in me. I go to sleep, I wake up in the morning, it's gone. And I learned about this, and it's something terrible. Well, for me, it was terrible. Occurred in my life when I was about, I don't know, I would say about 25, 26. And I couldn't sleep. But it was wrecking me. And then I just kind of turned to myself and said, every day a new day. Just let, you know, let the day work itself through you in sleep. And I would wake up, optimistic every morning because I'd made the decision that I wouldn't let things hang on me. You know, and I, that was way before I met the work, but it means that I'm an extremely successful sleeper, you know, which is a good thing. But then I have had dreams that were weird, right? And those have got nothing to do with working anything out. And I don't have them often. And I presume that they come from somewhere. I don't know if they belong to me. I mean, what do you ever know? I was, at one point in time, I was floating in the air in the region, in the streets where we had a house. And the whole of the streets were just covered with cats. And it had a certain feel to it. And it was like, this isn't me working something out. This is something trying to tell me something, it seemed. So the situation of dreaming is a very difficult situation, I think, because there are so many different aspects to it. And mostly dreams are just imagination working itself out and trying to digest things that need to be digested. And if you set those aside and you have experiences beyond that, then you have to ask what they are. But I don't think you can answer those questions, because really you're the only person that witnessed it. So you could tell me some story and say that you thought it meant this or it meant that, and I haven't got anything to say.
Right. So if you took a dream and said to yourself, well, this must be something that I'm being asked to do, then it would be somehow prophetic, but you would be doing it yourself. The dream itself would not have been had any power in and of itself to move you.
There was a dream that I had. I won't give much of the details, but it wasn't. I have no idea whether it was a dream. I don't think it was a dream. But certainly I had been very ill. And I became aware, let's say, in the middle of the night. And I heard something break. And my immediate thought was, a bone in my body has just broken. And I checked in the way that you would check by just sensing everything to see if there is any pain in your body, and there wasn't any. Mm-hmm. And then for the next period of time, I experienced a vision that I'm just not going to explain to anyone because it was just extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But I don't know why I got that. I don't know where it came from. But the one thing that You see, there are people who call themselves agnostics, and they call themselves agnostics because they haven't got any certainty about the way things are. And therefore, it's a convenient thing, which is an attitude of I don't know. But there are people that have high experiences and they don't believe in God. They already know. You know, it's not that they... it's not even that they have necessarily a conception of God, but when you have been in the presence of something that is much higher than you, right, then you know. And you don't need to. And in fact, I have no conception of what the absolute is in any form, but I do know something about it. Even if all that I saw or experienced was something that's two or three or four levels down from it. I don't know what level it was, but it was way more than I am. You could say that was dreaming, but there again, you know, intense reality feels like dreaming to the part of you that's mechanical. I don't know whether that helps.
No. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, thank you, Robin. We have been immensely blessed by your presence in all of the exchange. Would you like to give us a closing word for our time together? And then I will say a closing prayer for the evening.
Yeah, sure. So we talked about four bodies, but the body we have the great interest in is the Kesian body, or the astral body. Something that's not well known, in the sense that not many people in the work will ever say this, because I guess they never came across this. But the interesting thing about the Kesian body is that it actually has a unity. It doesn't have many eyes. The many eyes are the personality. The Kesian body is the unity. So there's something in you that's already there, if you could but make it active. And I wish for everybody that they could do that, that they could turn their Kesian body to be the active part of them, and the personality would start to, well, stop yapping at your heels, really.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you. Let us affirm together that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully in how blessed I am to simply remember God. Protect us, Lord, as we stay awake. Watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and asleep rest in Christ's peace. Amen. Oh.